So hi, for those of you who are new, welcome. I'm Stan Goldberg. I'm one of the GI attendings. If you don't mind, I'm going to sit so I can operate this a little bit easier. And I guess that this being July, we're going to focus on one of these core, you know, topics for you know, sort of more junior half-staff and talk about GI bleeding. Most specifically, we're going to focus on upper GI bleeding. But again, so and then, you know, again, if anybody has a question or a comment, certainly, you know, I'm more than happy to have you, you know, raise a hand or interrupt or shout, jump, whatever. You know, but again, so when we talk about GI bleeding, we normally like to differentiate between upper and lower GI bleeding. Again, for the purpose of this discussion, we'll primarily be talking about upper GI bleeding. I mean, obviously, we think about different etiologies and management for people who have acute versus chronic bleeding, although certainly in an inpatient setting, we'll see patients with both, those people who clearly present with evidence of ongoing or active or recent bleeding, and those people who come in more with the anemic consequences of chronic bleeding, and obviously also reverse versus the cult, those people who have ongoing, active, visible bleeding versus those where there's no obvious source of bleeding. Some of the terms that we use in gastroenterology and GI bleeding, obviously hematemesis, which is basically the vomiting of blood. You have coffee grind emesis, which is sort of a subset of hematemesis, but where there's been some chance for degradation of the blood in the stomach, and it's often more of a darker color. Melanoma, which is sort of a thick, pasty, dark stool that's often related to breakdown of heme products throughout the GI tract. And hematochezia, which is bright red blood corrector. And I'll just sort of, you know, I'll make the one brief comment that when I was in my training, I used to say if I had a dollar for every time I was called for melanoma that wasn't. So melanoma is not just, you know, dark stool or black stool, and or, you know, it's not really a color. It's a color, a consistency, and truth be told, an odor as well. So, you know, not everybody who has black stool, there could be dietary reasons, medication reasons. You know, but melanoma usually has sort of a thick, pasty type appearance. It's not just merely the color. Again, when we talk about acute upper GI bleeding, in most settings, we'll find that about 40% of people have ulcer disease, either duodenal, gastric, or some component of that. Some of the other pieces of this pie depend on your patient population. So certainly, in a city hospital such as ours, varices probably make up a good 10 to 12% of upper GI bleeding. In different practice settings, that might not be as true. You know, clearly esophagitis can make up a significant subset of patients who present with coffee grind emesis or even hematemesis, although that usually does not involve the same degree of hemodynamic instability. We'll talk a little bit about things like tumors, Mallory Weiss tears, and some of these rare causes. And again, I'll have some pictures to sort of match some of these terms later, but when, you know, in most studies you'll see about 5 to 10% of people will have some of these less common or rare causes of upper GI bleeding. Certainly ectasias or arterial venous malformations in different forms are common. Stromal ulcers are really more in postoperative patients, and it's something to think of as somebody who has a history of prior gastric resection. Dilatory lesions, which I'll show you a picture of and describe, but these are a significant cause of more often significant GI bleeding in a few patients. I think that when one is making that diagnosis, you really actually have to see a lesion. I've seen in my experience some people who have a patient with significant upper GI bleeding, they do an endoscopy, don't find an obvious source, and say, oh, it must be a dilatory lesion. And I think that's an inappropriate use of the term, but I'll explain why these are hard to find and what they look like and where they normally are. Watermelon stomach is also a not uncommon cause, which is often seen in patients as part of a spectrum of portal hypertensive gastropathy in patients with portal hypertension and some of the other things that we can see there. So the good news for most patients and physicians is that you know, most acute upper GI bleeding stops. And the words of my chairman, he says all bleeding stops eventually, depending on whether patients still have a blood pressure and a pulse at that point. But so again, in most series of upper GI bleeding, about 80% of patients will stop spontaneously and not re-bleed at all. About 20% of people will have either ongoing bleeding or more commonly will have, you know, they'll stop and then start again. The majority of those patients go on to do well, but, you know, it's been clear since the early age of endoscopy and endoscopic therapy, going back to about the 70s or so, that there is a stubborn subset of patients that actually still have mortality from upper GI bleeding. And while I'll show you the 1990 or so, that the mortality rate from acute in-hospital upper GI bleeding probably has declined to some extent, we'll also see that in many populations the rate is still 5 to 7, 5 to 8%, and not a whole lot different than it was 20 years ago. And hopefully we'll review some of the reasons why that doesn't mean that the therapy doesn't work or that we're not accomplishing anything, but that there are some patient variables and the variables that go into who gets hospitalized nowadays that may impact that. So again, if you're house staff in the middle of the night, if you're working in an emergency room, obviously, patients start throwing up blood, you're probably looking for a gastroenterologist. That's a reasonable thing to do. But don't forget that the initial management of GI bleeding is really the initial management of any unstable patient, airway, breathing, circulation. You basically need to evaluate the patient in terms of their hemodynamic parameters, try to ensure appropriate circulation, hydration, etc. And then once you adequately resuscitate a patient, you then need to take a look at both the prognostic factors in terms of where they may be bleeding from, how likely they are to need endoscopic therapy, how urgently they need endoscopy, and also try to determine level of care. Clearly there is a role for early endoscopy in trying to determine whether a patient with a not overly significant GI bleeding needs to be hospitalized at all. But also there are certain criteria that we can use, both clinical and possibly endoscopic, to determine the appropriate level of admission. So whether a patient needs a regular floor bed as opposed to an ICU bed. More often gets determined by their clinical factors rather than their endoscopic factors. So what are some of the adverse clinical prognostic factors? And this goes back to some of what I mentioned before of why it's been a little bit difficult to make significant headway in overall mortality. And I think that most people would agree that we see a sicker population of patients in hospitals today than we did 20 and 30 years ago. And some of these clinical prognostic factors that affect overall outcome from upper GI bleeding, are clearly things that we see more commonly today. So, patients who have multiple comorbid diseases, and I'll show you a slide that the more comorbid diseases such as heart failure, underlying lung disease, renal failure, etc., the patients have, affect their outcome with acute GI bleeding. Older patients tend not to do as well. And one of the variables that's important to realize is that patients who have in-hospital GI bleeding, so people who are already hospitalized, bless you, people who are already hospitalized for another cause who then develop acute upper GI bleeding have a worse prognosis than patients who present to the hospital with GI bleeding. Also, obviously, recurrent bleeding, and I think that sort of shock and red blood shouldn't be a surprise to anybody as a poor prognostic sign. And again, the endoscopic prognostic factors may not be as critical to you guys who are in the front line evaluating the patients when the bleeding starts, but certainly among the reasons to favor early endoscopy is trying to define what some of the findings are that predict or indicate a risk of recurrent bleeding or continued bleeding. And I'll give you some pictures of some of the things we see when we do endoscopy on these patients. So again, if you're taking a history in the setting of acute GI bleeding, obviously you'd like to know about medications, certainly those that can affect GI mucosa to begin with, such as aspirin and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents. Other over-the-counter medications, patients may be taking some combination medication for migraines, a whole host of things that may be ulcerogenic and may increase the risk of ulcer disease. Certainly anybody with a history of underlying drinking or known liver disease would certainly cause concern about the possibility of portal hypertension and esophageal varices. We know that especially in the pre-H. pylori era, the patients with a history of peptic ulcer disease often had recurrences. If someone's had a prior ulcer and either has an unknown H. pylori status or has never been evaluated, that would be a worthwhile piece of history. Something such as dysphagia, weight loss, heartburn might indicate more of an esophageal lesion or esophagitis. I think in the uncommon causes, there was aortoenteric fistula. A fairly uncommon cause of acute GI bleeding, but something that one has to keep in mind in anybody who has a history of a AAA repair. And again, some of the other factors that we talked about. And obviously, with medications as well, you want to know about any anticoagulation medications. But the initial examination, as I indicated before, is really more just trying to evaluate hemodynamic stability. So looking for signs of orthostasis. I think that
whenever I get a call from one of our GI fellows, you know, day or night, about a patient with presumed, you know, melanoma or metastasia, I always want to know not only what the character of the bowel movements are, but what the frequency is. Blood is a wonderful cathartic. People who are actively bleeding are moving their bowels. If someone comes in and the history is that they've been having melanoma for 3 days, when did they last move their bowels? You know, a day and a half ago, or you know, odds are that person, you know, not that they don't have a risk of re-bleeding, but that person is not currently bleeding. Okay, they could be a little hypertensive, they may be tachycardic, but the likelihood is that they haven't had a bowel movement, you know, in 12 plus hours, that they're not actively bleeding then, again, assuming that they're not just sitting there having recurrent hematemesis. But somebody who comes in with a history of, be it some coffee grind emesis or no vomiting at all, who is having dark stools, you know, that have sort of ceased, the likelihood is that they're not currently bleeding. Again, vomiting, and in terms of whether it's hematemesis, coffee grind emesis, looking for some clinical stigmata of liver disease, and then some of these other things. I mean, if you see somebody with multiple telangiectasias around their buccal mucosa, what entity might you think of? I'm sorry. Right, HHT or Alzheimer's. So certainly that can be a cause of recurrent GI bleeding, pigmented lesions such as in people with Peutz-Jeghers. There are some skin changes that are seen with certain GI malignancies such as gastric cancer. So you know, certainly you may find other skin changes or syndromal evidence that may make you think of a certain etiology. So again, this is sort of you know, pretty simplistic. But when you're thinking of somebody with acute upper GI bleeding, or I'll sort of say a bit of a tangent. You know, it's not uncommon that we get called to see patients because they're at heme positive stool, have, you know, a hemoglobin of let's say 6 or 7, and there may have been some history. They don't really pay attention. They're not sure whether or not they saw dark stool. And I'll sort of say that in that setting, MCV is a very useful parameter. Because people who are having an acute or subacute GI bleed, usually within a couple of days, probably haven't had enough time to become iron deficient or microcytic. Whereas people who are really having chronic GI bleeding and you know, it's unclear what they've been passing or whether there's been recent onset of bleeding, you know, are probably, you know, but over a period of time have had an opportunity to become microcytic. So it's certainly not the most sensitive number, but it's certainly one that's useful. You know, just be aware, as I'm sure you all know, that when you're talking about, you know, hemoglobin and somebody with an acute GI bleeding, your hemoglobin is basically the percentage of your plasma, which is blood cells. And so one can have, you know, a hematocrit of 40 or 45 and still be significantly volume depleted and have a significant bleed because, again, before bleeding, they may have more blood volume with, they may have an acute volume loss but still have the same percentage of their blood, which is red blood cells, and then as you equilibrate them, as they get hydration, they may first begin to sort of have a drop in hemoglobin associated with that. So it's another one of the reasons that hemodynamics are critical. You know, you don't want to take a patient who's diaphoretic, hypotensive, and start doing orthostatics on them, because you'll basically, you know, have a patient have a syncopal episode in front of you. But you know, certainly in terms of using common sense, if you have a patient who's got a reasonable blood pressure, isn't immensely tachycardic, it's a useful thing to measure as well, but just don't take hemoglobin as the be-all and end-all of how likely it is that the patient's having a significant bleed. And then, you know, obviously the cause of GI bleeding has a significant role both in terms of risk of re-bleeding and death. Patients with portal hypertension, esophageal varices, you know, may have a 50 to 60% incidence of re-bleeding and a mortality over a one-month period of up to 30%. Patients with malignancy as well have a higher incidence. And again, this is sort of what we talked about before, that even in the ulcer population, you know, the risk of mortality may still be in that 5% range. I'm not quite sure where this data would come from, that people with gastric erosions, you know, that number never made sense to me, and it may well be a manifestation of other comorbidities. One of the things that's somewhat reassuring, that the absence of a diagnosis, so if you have an endoscopy, you don't find a specific cause, usually has a good prognosis. So while we're never particularly satisfied if we don't find a specific cause for upper GI bleeding, in terms of patient outcomes, it usually means that we're not missing anything of great significance. And I mentioned this before as well, but certainly you see the mortality increases with the number of comorbid diseases. And I think that this is probably the older, the aging population, and the ability to maintain people for many years in spite of a number of significant comorbidities, I think is probably the greatest, the greater causes of why it is that it's been so difficult to actually show an over significant upper GI bleeding. And I think this slide is sort of self-explanatory. Okay, so a couple of moments on the role of NG tube in acute upper GI bleeding. And I think that, just by a show of hands, NG tubes are necessary or not necessary to evaluate somebody with an upper GI bleed? Who thinks they're necessary? Anyone? Okay. And unnecessary? Okay, and I guess everyone thought. So my experience is that this is a very institutional thing. Where I did my training, we never placed them, we never asked for them. I don't recall ever really wanting to base my my management on what was found in an NG tube. And I'll sort of say that similar to what I mentioned about some of the clinical signs and some of the endoscopic signs, NG tube findings may have a prognostic role, but I think they really should not have a diagnostic role. And the reason that I say that is that, and so basically the way that these studies were done, and most of them were done in the late 70s, is you had a patient come in with signs of upper GI bleeding, either hematemesis or melena, usually with hemodynamic instability. An NG tube is placed, and the patients all had upper endoscopy as part of their evaluation. And what was found is that even patients who had a clear NG aspirate, up to 10% had active bleeding at the time of their endoscopy, up to 6% still had bleeding from upper GI bleeding during the course of their hospitalization. Obviously, patients who had red blood on an NG aspirate had a higher incidence of active bleeding in death than patients without, but if you're going to decide whether or not to do an endoscopy based on the presence or absence of blood on an NG aspirate, you're obviously going to miss some patients. And even the same thing. So if you take a look at trying to correlate what the NG aspirate is and what the stool color is. So obviously, patients who have red blood from below and red blood from above have up to 30% mortality. Well, that's not a surprise. If you're vomiting red blood and you're having such rapid transit that there's been no time for degradation, that as opposed to passing brown stool or black stool, you're actually passing red blood from below, I think that that's probably not a huge surprise that that's a significant bleed, and these are patients who may well be having massive GI bleeding. But even in the setting of patients who have black stool and a clear NG aspirate, the mortality may be up to 5%. And I think that a lot of the older studies on NG tube and GI bleeding showed a rate of anywhere from 7 to 16% of active GI bleeding, even with a clear or negative NG aspirate. And, so again, 16% would be 1 in 6, which is really unacceptable and way too high. So I think if you have a patient who, and this really applies to a category of patients who are having bright red blood per rectum and hemodynamic instability, a lot of people like to assume that bright red blood per rectum is probably lower bleeding as opposed to upper bleeding. And sometimes we'll sort of say, well, if they're tachycardic or hypotensive and there's evidence of hemodynamic instability, then we're concerned about upper bleeding. But once you reach that point, my bias is that you should be doing an endoscopy and not an NG tube. Because if the NG tube is positive, that just told you something you already knew. And if the NG tube is negative and you're going to be reassured by that, I think you're asking for trouble. That said, within the Einstein hospitals, they do tend to like NG tubes. Many of the fellows will ask what the NG tube aspirate showed. So, and some of my colleagues, certainly find it useful. So I'm not going to say that you should refuse to do it or that no one can ask for the information, but I think that you should be aware of what the limitations are of the findings on an NG aspirate. And I'll sort of make the case as well that sometimes you'll see patients who are hemodynamically stable, have some coffee grind emesis, you put down an NG tube and you see some red blood, but the patient hasn't had a bowel movement in 12 hours, they're hemodynamically stable, it's far more likely that you caused some trauma with the NG tube and that you were just, fortunate that at the moment you passed the NG tube, the patient started actively bleeding. So again, I think one needs to consider that among other factors in terms of the urgency of evaluation. So here we go back to numerous studies dating back to the 50s, but as recently, as the early 1990s, showing no real difference in overall outcomes, that same mortality in that 5 to 8% range, different populations across the United States and the United Kingdom. And finally, from two cities in England, looking at their trends from the mid-70s to mid-80s, you finally do start seeing somewhat of a trend. But the truth is, over the last 25 years, these numbers have really more leveled off and continued to decline. I think that all comers in those populations, that rate is still in the 5% range. So, what is it that we're trying to do? Obviously, I'm a gastroenterologist. I'm an endoscopist. I obviously feel that there's a utility and a role to trying to manage these lesions through endoscopy and endoscopic therapy. I think when patients come in, there's rarely a reason to emergently do an endoscopy on a hemodynamically unstable patient. I think every patient deserves a trial of stabilization. So if you end up having somebody who has a massive, GI bleed and in spite of fluid and blood, you're not able to improve their hemodynamic parameters, sometimes we're forced, within the first couple of hours to try to come in and do something. I'll argue that many of those patients probably have lesions that are not well treated endoscopically and probably have a poor prognosis regardless of what one does for them. But considering the fact that most patients will sort of have an on and off turn to their bleeding, and that most of these patients are not massively, bleeding or exsanguinating, the majority of patients can be stabilized, with fluid, with blood products, if necessary, with things to include their clotting parameters. And then you're basically trying to decide the why, where, and when of endoscopy. So, diagnosis is nice. Everyone likes to know why a patient has something, and it's always great, but certainly most endoscopists don't see their role about doing a procedure on a weekend or in the middle of the night just to give a diagnosis. We'd like to normally do something therapeutic. Prognostic may have some role in terms of the appropriate setting to admit some patients, but really the whole goal of urgent endoscopic therapy for GI bleeding is endoscopic therapy and cessation of bleeding. So what are some of the things we look at? And the majority of this will really deal with how one treats various stigmata and ulcers. When we take a look at we said that ulcers make up about 40% of all causes of upper GI bleeding, and the stigmata that we see on those ulcers certainly have prognostic factors in terms of ongoing bleeding or re-bleeding. So what the lesion or the term that I'd like you to be familiar with by the time we're done today is what's referred to as the non-bleeding visible vessel. And I think that certainly if I think back to the era where I trained a little less than 20 years ago, we went from an era where you would do an endoscopy, if you saw bleeding, you treated it. If you didn't see bleeding, you sort of say, okay, everything looks quiet, we're going to save it for now. And we've really learned to appreciate various stigmata that have a risk of re-bleeding. So people who have, clean base or even what's called a flat spot have essentially no risk of re-bleeding or less than 5% and usually don't merit endoscopic therapy. People who have active oozing or arterial bleeding obviously are bleeding in front of you and clearly are lesions that one would want to treat. We've managed pretty successfully over the last 10 to 20 years to eliminate, to make this piece of the pie smaller and smaller, because we used to define adherent clot as a specific stigmata. And I think that most endoscopists, most therapeutic endoscopists in this day and age will try to move the clot and assess the underlying stigmata. So sometimes it's just not possible, but more often we'll either move a clot and find that there's a clean base underneath it, or move a clot and see that there is a vessel of some sort, either bleeding or not bleeding. But the non-bleeding visible vessel, and I think I have some other data, otherwise I'll discuss it afterwards, but it's clearly the lesion that as endoscopists we make the greatest impact on. So if you take a look at what the risk of re-bleeding is, so again, clean base ulcers, flat spots, it's less than 5%. Adherent clot really depends on what the underlying stigmata is. Arterial bleeding is sort of bizarre because obviously if it's bleeding when you get there, it really should be 100%. But if you take a look at control studies of non-bleeding visible vessels, without treatment, the risk of re-bleeding is about 40%. And when you talk about how one designs a really quick, nice to do clinical research trial, and I think it was probably in the late 80s, early 90s, one of the best endoscopic studies on this topic was done. I believe that I can't remember if it was a UCLA or a USC institution, but it was done by a guy named Lauren Lane, and that whatever LA County Hospital is associated with, whichever Los Angeles Medical School. But he would basically go through the ER first thing in the morning, ask the ER attendings where are the GI bleeders from the night before. He'd go over, interview them, tell them that he was interested in looking at a specific type of lesion on endoscopy. If they had this lesion, would they be willing to participate? People would sign consent. He would do an endoscopy. If they had a non-bleeding visible vessel, he would rip open a randomization envelope and randomize the patient either to endoscopic therapy or to observations in this trial. But he found that control group without endoscopic therapy had a 41% rebleeding rate. The treatment group after endoscopic therapy had a 7% rebleeding rate. And it totally revolutionized the way that we think about and evaluate this lesion. And as I said, it probably made the biggest headway. And as I showed you in that pie, this may be up to 20 to 25% of all lesions that we see in acute upper GI bleeding. So clearly, you know, an important lesion. So just the show and tell part of this talk. So again, this is normal, you know, gastric mucosa. This is sort of the border of a nice clean base, this sort of white exudate of a fairly benign, typical looking gastric ulcer. It's hard to see on the image, and it's also hard to see if you're not used to doing it for a while, but, you know, even though you're looking at a two-dimensional image, you can appreciate the concept of three dimensions on an endoscopic image. So you're going to have to take my word that this is really a flat spot. It's neither depressed or elevated, and so flat spots, whether they're discolored or white, really don't have much of a prognostic factor in terms of the risk of GI bleeding. But elevated lesions might. And so this is sort of a typical adherent clot. This is a clot coming off the base. As I said, nowadays we'd be more concerned about trying to move that and see what was under it. And this is really the, a classic example of what's referred to as a visible vessel. So it may be hard to appreciate the fact that, again, this is sort of the periphery of the ulcer here, and this lesion right in the middle is actually elevated and coming off the base. And the pathophysiology of that could be several fold, but sometimes it's actually, you know, an ulcer depression here and just sort of a vessel that's coursing through. Sometimes you've actually had some bleeding and either, you know, closing off with some clot or just development in the pseudoaneurysm. But the point is, this is a significant caliber vessel that's exposed that clearly is still at risk of puncturing and rebleeding, which is probably why this lesion, even in a non-bleeding state, has such a high risk of rebleeding. And again, this is on obviously a surgical specimen, sort of seeing the same thing with an adherent clot over it, but almost like a volcano type lesion coming up to the surface. Another example of that. So this is sort of oozing. And, you know, this is one of those things that, you know, they say when you crawl to a code, you should basically take your own pulse first. But this is the same sort of thing if you're a young endoscopist and you see blood squirting up from the site. You should basically, you know, just take a step back at your bearings and say, okay, there's some work to be done. Again, this is sort of, again, just some show and tell of some of the less common lesions. So this is a fairly typical looking, it's actually not a great example. Usually when you see a classic arteriovenous malformation or ectasia, it'll look like a spider angioma, just like you've seen in patients with portal hypertension or a spider vein. This one is a little, if you had shown me this picture and said this is a suction artifact, I couldn't argue with you, but this is supposed to be an example of an ectasia. And this is an example of a dulopoid lesion. So let me just describe what that lesion is. Obviously, a dulopoid was described by, I believe it was a pathologist by the name of dulopoid. It is a persistent caliber arteriole. So it's actually a, it's not an ectasia in the same classic sense. This is a vessel that courses much closer to the mucosa than a vessel of this caliber normally should, even in the absence of any ulceration or mucosal abnormality. They're most commonly found in the stomach. They're most commonly found in the upper stomach, usually within about 3 centimeters of the gastroesophageal junction. And so the point I was trying to make before is that if you're doing an endoscopy on a patient with upper GI bleeding and you don't find one of the normal suspects, so you don't find evidence of ulcer disease, you know, in the stomach or the duodenal bulb, you don't find any esophageal pathology, including esophagitis or a Mallory Weiss tear, it's probably a reasonable thing to search in the proximal stomach for some sort of a vessel or, you know, elevated area. It doesn't always look as though it's bleeding. Sometimes it looks like a non-bleeding visible vessel, but without an underlying ulcer. But once one doesn't find such a lesion, my view is it's a little bit irresponsible to say, oh, it must be a dulopoid, but I'm a wonderful endoscopist and I didn't see a source. So I have certainly encountered that through the years, but I think that when you see the lesion, this can really be a cause of massive or significant upper GI bleeding, and it's certainly an important lesion to recognize and find. This fits into the concept of what's called watermelon stomach. If you can sort of see these red stripes coming along over here, sort of like the outside of a watermelon, which can exist on its own, but the majority of these are part of a spectrum of portal hypertensive gastropathy. Again, you always want to get a good look at the guest or esophageal junction. This is where, this is a diaphragmatic pinch where the diaphragm is pinching on the upper part of the stomach. These are gastric folds coming up to what this is, which is the gastroesophageal junction. So again, without being overly specific, so this area from here to here is actually a hiatal hernia. And this red area here is sort of a linear tear, which is a classic place for a malignant tear. Also a cause of what can be significant upper GI bleeding. These are small esophageal varices, and these are somewhat larger and recently bleeding esophageal varices. Okay, so that's the spectrum of some of the things that can bleed. And then the question is, what are our options? How do we treat these people? So certainly, if you go back to, you know, the history of GI bleeding, that's been going on for quite a while. You go back to the history of endoscopy, that only exists for about, you know, maybe the last 30 to 35 years. You go back to the history of therapeutic endoscopy, which may only exist for about 25 years or so. And so what are some of the things that people have tried? And if you take a look in older data, you'll see things about, you know, nasogastric lavage, ice water lavage, hot water lavage. None of that really has any role. People will take a look at antacids, haven't really worked all that effectively. Interestingly, although H2 receptor antagonists don't work, I think that some of the data that was gleaned from that is that one of the reasons that they may not have worked is that patients on continuous H2 receptor antagonists develop tolerance. So over time, their bodies can overcome that and start producing acid. And the main reason that they may not have worked had more to do with the ability to sustain a more neutral pH rather than the fact that that affecting pH has no role. And certainly people have looked at vasopressin, octreotide, although octreotide has some use in Europe, even in the setting of ulcer bleeding, we tend to use it more in portal hypertensive training. But the overwhelming majority of these things, you know, were shown not to be particularly beneficial, although for some of you may already have experience of seeing that nowadays we pretty much see these proton pump inhibitors, and so the question is why and how and why should they work and what do they actually do. This is an old study looking at famotidine intravenously, and regardless of the cause, ulcer disease, varices, Mallory-Weiss tears really didn't do any better than placebo in terms of stopping bleeding. And interestingly, the first attempt to look at IV omeprazole, which was obviously the first PPI, I think this study was done back in 1992, so really no benefit in terms of any of the outcomes, including mortality. But what they basically did was take all comers, I think it was over 1,000 patients, everybody got, you know, some IV omeprazole, and in a large series where they didn't factor in prognostic factors of re-bleeding, they really showed no benefit. So the first study that really showed, you know, some benefit was sort of useless by the time it got published. It was a study that was published in the New England Journal, I believe, in 1997 out of India by an author named Kuru. It's one that's widely cited in the literature. But the problem with it was that it was in a place or a facility where they didn't have the ability to do therapeutic endoscopy. And certainly by the late 90s, you know, almost every facility in the United States was offering that. So this didn't really seem to have great practical application. But what they did was, rather than looking at all comers, they took a look at patients who had a diagnostic endoscopy, those who had evidence of bleeding anywhere from an adherent clot to a visible vessel and onward. And they actually did find that giving, BID or TID oral omeprazole seemed to have an overall benefit both in terms of mortality, surgery, and re-bleeding on their whole population. And when they actually did subgroup analysis by defining whether patients had, you know, active bleeding or oozing or what else, they found that they made the greatest effect on those patients with non-bleeding visible vessel and adherent clot. Anybody with any insight as to why that might be? Anybody still awake? I mean, I think that part of the purpose is, and one of the reasons that this has actually been recognized as a way to improve outcomes in patients with acute GI bleeding, is that there's nothing about controlling pH that's going to take a bleeding lesion and make it stop bleeding. But there is a role of pH in terms of how clotting factors work, how fibrin helps degrade clot, how other issues go on. And so it really is a goal to try to maintain pH greater than 4 to allow the body's own hemostatic mechanisms to kick in and have an impact. So for those lesions that are not actively bleeding at the time of endoscopy, specifically clot and non-bleeding visible vessel, it does make sense to get pH above a certain level. may have a great benefit in terms of preventing bleeding. So while this was not particularly applicable to how we were treating patients in the United States at the time that it got published, it at least opened some thoughts and avenues about what we might be able to do and whether PPIs had a role in the management of acute upper GI bleeding. So the study that was more applicable to what we do in the United States was actually published by Lau and colleagues in Hong Kong about 10 years ago. I believe this was in 2000. And what they did was they gave IV PPI therapy to patients after endoscopic treatment for GI bleeding. And they basically found that, so once patients basically had an endoscopy, they had an ulcer that required endoscopic therapy, and then they randomized them to either placebo or IV omeprazole over, I believe it was, I can't remember if it was 3 or 5 days, but they found that, rebleeding in the placebo group was, 24 versus 5. There were 120 patients in each trial. Patients who needed retreatment for endoscopic therapy, and I don't believe they should actually, even mortality did not reach, clinical significance, but it was, double the mortality in the small group of patients. And so this was the first study that really showed the benefit of what we take as common practice today, which is using IV PPIs after endoscopic therapy. Now, I'll just sort of say that if you were to read the package insert on any of the IV proton pump inhibitors available in the United States, would any of them indicate therapy after endoscopic therapy as an indication for usage? Anyone know what they're approved for? And basically, the IV PPIs are approved, I believe, for two indications. One is for patients with diagnosed Zollinger-Ellison syndrome who are unable to take PO, and patients with a history of reflux disease who are maintained on an oral dose of a PPI who are not able to take PO either because of post-op or other reasons. And the reason is that when they tried doing these studies in the United States, and at that time the one IV PPI that was available was IV pantoprazole, they had such difficulty recruiting the number of patients that they needed based on all the exclusion criteria that they never completed the studies to get the approval from the FDA in the United States. And we at Jacoby were actually one of about 250 sites in that study. I think we actually randomized 8 or 9 patients, which made us in the top 10 of institutions in terms of numbers of patients that we randomized. But I think at the end of the day, the company that manufactured it realized that there was enough data from other countries that people were using it, that they didn't necessarily, that once the drug was available, they didn't really care what the indication was. And so by and large, this has caught on as standard of care probably for the last 8 to 10 years. And again, this is another diagram or from data papers in that slide, but basically most of the rebleeding that we see occurs within the first 3 to 5 days. So, the majority of these people who rebled did so within the first 5 days. Once you got through the first 5 days, these numbers didn't really change. And so that's why for most of these people, they require 3 to 5 days of in-hospital observation, with the IV PPI. And then if you take that one step further and say, we know that if you have stigmata of ulcer and you give an IV PPI, that may allow for better stabilization after therapy. What happens, when the patient comes in, if you give a PPI at that point, does that have any role? Does that have any benefit? And again, for those of you who've done the ICU rotations or ER rotations to date, it's probably something that you've seen, that a patient comes in with evidence of significant GI bleeding and, they get an IV PPI and if they have evidence of portal hypertension, then they also get IV octreotide. But the data from this comes from that same group in Hong Kong. This was published in 2007. And what this really showed is that if you start the IV PPI at presentation, that when you then do endoscopy on these patients, the likelihood is that they're going to have fewer stigmata or recent hemorrhage. So again, the people who get who have the IV PPI, a higher number of them actually have a clean-based ulcer as opposed to having active bleeding or non-bleeding visible vessels or some of these other stigmata. Presumably, even that initial 12 to 18 hours from the time of presentation to endoscopy may be enough for IV PPI to have a role in initial healing to assess some of the stigmata, even in that short length of time. So for those lesions that require endoscopic therapy, what are our options? And obviously there are a whole slew of things that people can do through an endoscope. So there are medications that we can inject, and I'll show you some examples of that. There are different types of thermal probes that we can use either with direct contact or direct laser or
what type of reactional politics has affected this
standard in many places, and I'm told that we may finally be getting one here after a while, and then a whole host of clips and bands, and I'll show you a video at the end with some examples of that. So again, in terms of some of the probes that we use, some of them have needles at the end so that we can inject different types of medications. Some of them just allow attachment to a cautery source so that we can burn lesions. The idea of using electrothermal modalities is that it's really a concept of what's called coaptive coagulation. It's not just a matter of applying heat, but you actually want to do it with force. So that's why the example here is showing that you're actually indenting the area as you're transmitting current to try to get this vessel that's running, you know, submucosally under here to sort of seal off and coagulate. In terms of the inject case, there's a whole slew of things, but by and large for ulcer disease, what we're using is dilute epinephrine. If you're injecting epinephrine intravenously during CPR, it's usually a dilution of 1 to 1,000. We're using a 1 to 10,000 dilution. The purpose of this is twofold. As you inject the epinephrine, it obviously has a vasoconstrictive effect, but even just injecting the fluid in that site has a local tamponade effect. So you're really relying more on the tamponade effect initially, and then sort of what you're injecting to sort of allow a vasoconstrictive effect. And many, some of these other substances are used for sclerotherapy for varices, and others such as hypertonic saline are rarely used, if at all, including thrombin. And there the therapy usually begins, that as opposed to going directly into the vessel to begin with, or in the slide that I showed you on the coaptive source, you're going right onto the vessel. Usually when you're injecting, you initially begin by injecting four quadrants around the vessel, and then you may inject into the middle of it. But the bottom line of all of that is that whereas medical therapy doesn't do a whole lot, any of the injection or coagulation therapies tend to work pretty well. There is some data that's more recent than this that seems to argue that the combination of an injection modality and a thermal modality may work better than either one alone, and I think that's probably what we use, you know, most often. The endpoint lesson of this is that endoscopists should use whatever modality they're most comfortable and experienced with, because probably any of them work reasonably well. And that sort of shows the same thing with the rebleeding rate. You know, even if you have to do it for initial control and rebleeding, that medical treatment obviously, you know, may have a high rebleeding rate, but almost all of the others have rebleeding rates that are, again, this is somewhat older data, but usually less than 10% by the time we're done. So as I said before, about 80% stop. So, you know, the majority of that side is a different slide, I take that back. So in patients who have therapeutic endoscopy for either a bleeding or a non-bleeding lesion, over 80% will have one endoscopy, have their therapy done, and have permanent control. Maybe 15 to 20% will rebleed. Of those with the second endoscopy, at least half, if not more, could be controlled. Some people just have a caliber of vessel that really isn't amenable to the small probes that we could put through an endoscope. Some of them may have a lesion positioned at an angle that it's very hard to get good coaptive force. And so that still represents the subset of patients that may not be well controlled endoscopically. And those patients can either have an option to have an interventional radiologist try to do angiography and insert a coil or some other modality, or a small subgroup of patients that may still need surgery for for upper GI bleeding. So I think I sort of covered all this. But in terms of the endoscopic findings and what do we need to do, so, you know, flat spots, clean based ulcers, you know, somewhat lower risk of rebleeding, usually don't need endoscopic therapy. Overlying clot, you really want to figure out what's underneath it. Visible vessel, anywhere from a 30 to 50% risk of rebleeding, and clearly should have endoscopic therapy. And people who have active GI bleeding clearly should have endoscopic therapy. This is sort of the same thing, and I'm not going to belabor that. Yeah, so again, when we talk about the initial management, the acute management, I talked about the ABCs of stabilization. You want to try to assess the onset and the severity of bleeding to try to determine whether this is somebody, you know, that really needs urgent or emergent endoscopy. The roles of urgent endoscopy, as we said, is that it provides, you know, diagnosis, assistant triage, may allow for early discharge in the setting of a clean-based ulcer, but most importantly, especially in an emergency setting or an urgent setting, is to try to control active bleeding and identify high-risk lesions. I'll give you a little video of an example of an app. Here, so you can sort of see blood pumping from right here. There's volume, but I don't know how to increase the volume on this, so that's okay. Okay, so this is the pylorus is over there. This is sort of in the antrum of the stomach. This is taking an injector needle, okay, into the area where the bleeding was and injecting dilute epinephrine to try to get that initial tamponade and vasoconstrictive effect. And then you can sort of see over here, once they clean that off, that there's sort of a vessel on top. So I wouldn't really call this a non-bleeding visible vessel because it was actively pumping, but you know, there's an example, you know, a big ulcer in a relatively small, sorry, a big vessel in a relatively small ulcer. I mean, the area around it didn't look nearly as big as some of those clean-based ulcers that I showed. Let's check this over. That'd be something. Yeah, I may have backed up a little bit. So there's here sort of an ulcer base around here, the vessel in the middle of it. And this is, I'm just taking a clip and sort of ablating that vessel to allow more permanent hemostasis. And so the vessel is sort of smack in the middle. They're taking a clip and firing that. And that's sort of the vessel sealed off with a clip. So, I mean, as you can, you know, and that's pretty gratifying, for lack of a better term. I mean, that's pretty good hemostasis. I think the follow-up on this case that they gave is that patient actually got re-endoscoped about a month later, you know, just to assess for full healing, and there was, you know, no further concern for that. You know, just briefly, I guess I have a couple of minutes, so I'll talk a little bit about variceal bleeding. So again, esophageal varices are one of the alternative paths that circulation can take once you have scarring in the liver, often as a result of cirrhosis in our population, primarily due to chronic hepatitis, usually hepatitis C or alcohol abuse. Sclerotherapy, which is done rarely nowadays, involves injecting some sort of a caustic substance into these areas to sort of allow almost saponification and scarring of these areas. I think that one of the things that we've known for a long time is that unfortunately it may decrease transfusion requirement, may decrease death due to bleeding, but overall does not necessarily affect long-term survival. And I think that because of the complications, stricturing pain, etc., this is no longer a preferred method of treating varices. And nowadays what we tend to do is attach this cap with what are called band ligation kits that allow us to sort of fire rubber bands and grab these varices and ablate them in that way. And so compared to sclerotherapy, this causes lower complication rates, fewer treatment sessions. Usually it takes 2 to 3 sessions to ablate varices in the esophagus with a band ligation kit as opposed to anywhere from 4 to 6 treatments using sclerotherapy. And here's a picture. This is this sort of clear or plastic cap, which is why you have a limited view of the attachment. Then these little circular areas are what the bands look like after you've ablated them. Just a couple of words about, you know, H. pylori. I think we know that nowadays the majority of ulcers are either related to NSAIDs or H. pylori. So if you're talking about recurrence rate of ulcers and how to reduce that, clearly eradicating H. pylori, you know, has a role on that. So, you know, prevention of recurrence of ulcer disease or assessing H. pylori status and treating that. If patients don't have H. pylori, there's probably a role to maintain acid reduction therapy and obviously avoiding non-steroidals. I'm just trying to see what I still have left here. I'm going to skip that one. Again, indications for emergency surgery. In this era, predominantly failure of endoscopic therapy or just inability, you know, to if someone's having ongoing hematemesis and an inability to even stabilize them, it may be more appropriate to operate more urgently than trying to endoscope them. And I'm going to skip over that and stop. And I'll stay around if anybody has any questions.